Proverbs 18, verse 12 says, "Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit." The word tongue is in the Bible 114 times. The word lips is in the Bible 118 times. The word mouth is in the Bible 394 times. The word voice is in the Bible 458 times. Obviously, this is an important topic in the Bible. All the uses for good and bad of our voices. Of that verse that I just quoted from the New King James, the Good News Bible says, "What you say can preserve life or destroy it, so you must accept the consequences of your words." The God's Word translation has sort of a funny translation. It says the tongue has the power of life and death. Those who love to talk will have to eat their own words. Yeah, we are held responsible for our words, for either our good or bad. My focus specifically is on criticism. The word has various definitions. There's good and bad criticism, helpful and unhelpful, positive and negative, or what I'm calling it, and this is the title of my sermon, constructive criticism versus destructive criticism. Constructive criticism versus destructive criticism. Now, I don't mean have a narrow definition of the word criticism, because we could practically call the sermon constructive communication versus destructive communication. But this is certainly important for God's people, because we are the people who are supposed to be the lights of the world, to set the right example of love versus hate, of helping and not and healing and not hurting. And so we do have a big responsibility to set a right example. The sermon is mostly about giving all kinds of criticism, a little bit about how we receive it, but that's a big subject in itself, and perhaps I'll give another sermon sometime on how do you receive instruction and correction. You know, what is your attitude and how do you react when somebody does instruct you or criticize you? I don't mean by focusing on criticism to diminish the many other ways that we serve with our tongues. Another important subject is thanking and being grateful and expressing gratitude, complimenting, encouraging, praising, comforting people. There's many other related important subjects, and I don't mean to diminish those at all, but this is a subject that perhaps we don't speak on as often, and I thought that it would be very good for us to really focus on this and to get clarity about how this can be a good thing or a bad thing. Now, when it comes to positive constructive criticism, there's other good synonyms for that: making suggestions, advising, evaluating, critiquing, correcting, assessing, reviewing. And that implies doing it with attitudes of respect and humility and encouragement. And then when it comes to the destructive criticism, we can divide that into two categories: what you are saying directly to the person and what you're saying behind the person's back. In other words, you could be very kind of mean and critical and harsh when you go up to somebody to criticize, where you're disparaging and insulting and condemning and fault-finding. But what is even more common is where the negative criticism is not directly to the person. It's what is said behind the person's back to other people, whether it's complaining, griping, accusing, slandering, gossiping. So often, when a person does have a legitimate issue that would be helpful to a person, then instead of going to that person, we see it's much more likely that people will just talk to other people, practically anybody else. Often the last person that they tend to go to is the person who really is the one who needs to hear it, which is a shame. It's just hard for most people to make themselves go talk to somebody face to face. We live in a world where we're surrounded by bad influences. We hear all the partisan politics and the news people competing with each other is to try to have the most sensational news and expose somebody's faux pas or faults or sins or mistakes. And where if you do make a mistake, then that's really going to be blasted in the news media. And it is so disrespectful. It's a society where we hardly use the words ladies and gentlemen anymore, because it seems like ladies aren't ladylike and gentlemen are not gentlemanly-like. There is such a terrible lack of respect in our society. I want to make clear very early on in this sermon that when I'm talking about coming and giving constructive criticism face-to-face with somebody, this includes going to elders, to ministers, just as much as anyone else. I imagine there are people who have the lingering idea from way, way back, well, you can't go disagree with a minister or correct a minister or point out something that is a fault or a mistake or something like that. I hope that if you still have that lingering thought, that you soon will get over it, because there is no double standard. We elders are primarily, our relationship with you is just as a brother. And everything in the Bible applies to us just the very same way as it applies to everyone else. And if we make a mistake, we need to hear about it. We need the feedback and advice and suggestions and so forth. In fact, the quality of leadership of any kind of leader largely depends on the kind of advice that he gets from others. The quality of a president of the United States largely depends on who he picks for his cabinet and other advisors, because they are going to influence him a great deal. And so it's always quite telling to see who a president picks for his cabinet. And then you kind of know, well, even more so about what to expect from him. So we are all like cabinets to each other. We're advisors to each other. We're here to help each other. And we'll all do better if we get positive, helpful feedback from you. Now, of course, we all need encouragement and a pat on the back and those things. But when we do make mistakes or when we are falling short in some way, then we need to be aware. Somehow we've got to become aware of that. And I'm certainly not the sharpest tool in the tool shed, and I need all the help I can get. And I do believe that no one has ever been shouted at by me or yelled at or I've never gotten angry with anybody because of criticizing me. I just realized that would be terrible, that when you build up the courage to come and give me some criticism, that I would hurt you in return for that. It's hard enough. It's hard enough to be brave enough to go face somebody and say, I disagree with you, or I think you made a mistake, or something like that. And so when somebody comes to me, they're probably going to be correct. And then I realize that I've done something wrong, and I'll apologize. If I think you're not correct, well, then I'll try to explain why I think you're not correct, and we can have a two-way discussion about it and hopefully come to an understanding, because perhaps there's a misunderstanding, you see. But We elders try very hard not to be on the defensive in the sense that, oh, we're thin-skinned and we, you know, we can't take a correction or something like that. So we invite you to come whenever you disagree with something or question something or don't understand something or think want to see whether what did we really mean when we said something, then please come, you see. I can tell you, I am certainly more emotional and eager to stop somebody when I see somebody else is being hurt. Let me give you an analogy, because the Bible uses the analogy of a shepherd and sheep a lot. The shepherd's job is partly to keep one sheep from hurting another sheep, because oftentimes that happens. One sheep will be kind of mean and start butting other sheep. And it's a shepherd's job to notice and to be aware of that and to put a stop to it. And so one of our responsibilities as elders is that to try to notice if one member is hurting another member and to step in, if necessary, to put a stop to that. And I'm much more concerned about that than whether, let's say, I'm getting my feelings hurt. Because by the time you're an elder, or by the time you, especially by the time you've been an elder for a while, you've had a lot of criticism. So we're pretty tough-skinned when it comes to ourselves. So I'm going to give you seven fundamental keys to define constructive criticism. And I'm talking mostly about constructive criticism, but of course the opposite of neglecting these keys would be destructive criticism. So seven keys to make it clear as to what I mean by constructive criticism. Number one, if possible, build bonds and bridges with all your brethren as quickly as possible. Let's think of correction as being driving a truck. You can't just drive a truck across a big chasm, a big valley where there's no road or no bridge. And people can take disagreements and correction much more readily and easily when they feel like you have already shown yourself to be a friend, a real brother, or a real sister. And so there are many reasons to get to know everybody in the congregation and to develop love for everyone in the congregation, and to build camaraderie and a closeness and the love and the rapport and the close relationships and all. But one of the advantages is that if you ever see that person who's your friend doing something you think is wrong, that is going to hurt himself or herself or hurt somebody else, that you can go and feel pretty confident that that person is going to listen to you and know that you mean well, that you've got good intentions, that you're just trying to help, that you're not trying to hurt them, and that you don't view yourself as some kind of a know-it-all sheriff who's going around just looking for people's faults so that you can point the finger at them and show them their faults. They're going to know that you're coming as a loving brother or sister to do that. Now, if you see somebody that you hardly know, but you're pretty sure they're doing something wrong, then it gets to be kind of touchy as to whether you can say anything to them or not. It's like, because a person might think, look, we've been in this church for 6 months or a year or 3 years together, and you've hardly ever spoken to me. But now, when you think I'm doing something wrong, now you come and speak to me. You see how different that can be than if you've already built a relationship. And then you can come and say, well, hey, let me put a bug in your ear about this. So let's turn to Revelation 12. It's a wonderful, wonderful chapter about relationships. You know, the Bible is a book about relationships, our relationship with God, our relationship with our brethren, our relationship in families, relationships with friends and people that we work with in the world. And that is top priority. So let's look at some verses here. Revelation 12 and verse 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. In other words, don't just feign love. Don't just put on an act of love, but let it be really true love. Verse 10, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another. Now let's go down to verse 13. Distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Almost sounds like addicted to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. That's real empathy. That's real sympathy. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. In other words, don't just don't practice favoritism toward people who maybe will do more for you in return. So it's kind of a selfish thing, or whether you think they're kind of beneath you or something. Because God's church should be a truly amazing place, a rather miraculous place, in the sense that God is the one that does the calling. And so we end up with a pretty motley crew, a pretty diverse group. We have people with all different income levels, all different races, all different cultural backgrounds, and all different interests and all that. And to begin with, the only thing we have in common is we have the same understanding of the Bible, that God is calling us and opening our minds to understand spiritual truth. But that, once God does call you, and once you do have the Holy Spirit, we have by far the strongest bond of all other bonds, so that we can feel deeply close to people that otherwise we would have hardly anything in common with. So even though we already have that in common, yet we do need to get to know each other. We do need to start getting to know each other's names and spending time together and talking to each other so we get to know each other. Many years ago, I heard this phrase, and I imagine 99% of you in this room have heard this statement. But this has been one of the most helpful statements to sort of guide me in my thinking of almost anything, and that is this: people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I wish I had let that guide me all my life, even when I was young, because when I was a kid, I had the mistaken idea that if I could just excel in things and kind of impress other people, that people would like me, that you know, I'd really be surrounded by friends because they were impressed with whatever I did. But I finally matured enough and wised up enough with the help of the Bible and all that to realize, no, what's going to attract people to you is whether you love them. It's not how smart you are or how much you technically know the Bible or how many talents you have and all that. What is going to really bind you together is to know that you care about them. That means by far more than anything else. So, if you are in the congregation, there are probably going to be times when you see that somebody needs a bit of advice, that somebody needs a helping hand, that needs to be steered in the right direction, needs to be questioned on what appears to be a mistake or whatever. And it's just going to be so much easier for you to do that if they already know that you care. You've already shown that you care. So we need to be spending time with one another. We need to nurture those relationships. So if you get to know the person, you get to know their personality, and then you can anticipate what the reaction is going to be. Now, of course, sometimes I've been mistaken. Sometimes I thought I knew the person well enough. I thought we were good enough friends, and so I brought up something that was sort of correction or disagreement, and the person got offended. And so I thought, oh, no, what a shame. Now, of course, I hope they still thought more about what I said and maybe did make a change in their lives. But it is risky, I admit. But real life, if you're going to do the right thing in life, you're going to have to run some risk. And when it comes to relationship, there are risks. Because if you disagree with somebody, you give a little bit of correction, they might get mad. Yeah, or act hurt, or like, oh, you're stupid for thinking that, or whatever. So there is that risk, but that doesn't happen in most cases, and it's worth it. If you think you can really help, then it's worth taking the risk. But of course, don't go in just because you're trying to be picky and find some little thing, and you're like the church policeman going around looking for little things to correct, and you're coming on in a superior way, and you're accusatory and judgmental, and you're finger-pointing. And I'll get back to that subject of attitudes more later. But think of it that way, that you want to start building bridges so that when the time comes, you can drive a little truck across that bridge that would be a little bit corrective. Number two, the second key is your motive. Motive. The motive should be love. Paul, in the beginning of the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, he says, if I have not love, no matter what else I have, if I have not love, I'm nothing. But I want to turn to Hebrews 12, and let's look at the example of how God the Father and Jesus Christ deal with us, because God is the perfect parent, and he treats us like his children. And so let's begin in verse 5, Hebrews 12 and verse 5. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the eternal loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. Now, this principle is throughout the Bible. It shows that we need soft love and tough love. Soft love is the encouragement, compliments, hugs and kisses and smiles and affection. But the tough love is when correction and discipline and things like that. And the Bible's very clear that if it's all one-sided and there's never rules, I mean, if you're a parent, for example, and you don't give your children rules and you don't back up those rules and you don't enforce those rules and you don't discipline in an appropriate way, then it's not true love. It's like half of your love component is missing. And the full love is not there. And so this makes it clear that when God corrects us, we know for sure what his motive is. Whatever God does to try us and test us and correct us and chasten us, he does it out of love. And likewise, when we go to disagree with somebody or question somebody or correct somebody, that our motive should be love as well. So verse 7, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? Well, of course, in this modern day and age, I think we say there are lots of fathers that don't chasten. It's such an anti-rules and anti-law and anti-discipline society we're getting into. Verse 8, but if you are without chastening, of which you all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. In other words, Even in a human family, a child does not really feel as loved if there are no rules and no enforcement. Because if the child begins to sense, you know, my parents really love me, they would care about what I do, but they just let me do anything. Verse 9, furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chasten us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit. Well, hopefully human parents do it for the profit of the child as well. But what this is saying is that sometimes human parents make mistakes, but God never makes a mistake. It's always for our profit and benefit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Yet afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Again, if we come with love, our desire should be to produce fruits of righteousness, good fruits, you see. So that motive of love should be like God's motive. And do you know what? When you love someone, you cut them a lot of slack, don't you? You're not real picky if you really love somebody. When you love and respect someone, you assume the best. If they make a mistake, you probably think, oh, well, they had good intentions. They meant well. It's not a big deal. You know, it's easy to forgive and all those things. But, you know, if there's somebody you don't know and you don't like, and you got a bad impression of them, they make a mistake and you think, oh, that was terrible. And you tend to make a bigger deal out of it. You don't cut them as much slack. See, so there's a huge benefit in forming real love with people, because then you're much more merciful toward them when they do make mistakes. You give them the benefit of the doubt and all of that. And you realize, hey, my relationship with that person is much more important than picking on every little mistake and making a big deal out of every mistake and being complaining and fault-finding and all that. And, of course, this is good advice for us married people, because very easy to start being too picky and fault-finding with our spouses. So we need the right motive, and not to be selfish and self-centered and just taking pleasure in correcting and putting other people down, because that kind of makes me feel better by comparison, like I kind of feel superior, and where the motive can be to attack and assassinate somebody's character. So the motive must be love. Number three, what is the purpose? What is the purpose? Well, the very fact that I call it constructive criticism means that we're trying to construct. And a synonym for that is edify. And the Bible uses the word edify quite a bit. So we're going to go to Romans 14. Romans 14 and verse 19. It says, therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace, and the things by which one may edify another. The word edify, as the margin says here, means to build up. Now, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because another name for a building is an edifice. And so you build an edifice by edifying. And so we're trying to do beneficial things and constructive things. And then let's go to the next chapter, chapter 15. Chapter 15 and verse 1. Then we who are strong ought to bear with the scruples or the weaknesses or the strange ideas of the weak, and not to please ourselves. Now, verse can be taken perhaps several ways, but as I understand it, it means we need to be very patient with people and not just be trying to make everybody in our own image and trying to make other people like me. Like, if you don't think like me and you don't act like me, well, then you're wrong. But to respect everybody and their differences, and not to be selfish. And verse 2, let each of us please his neighbor for his good, leading to edification. Not for some selfish reason, for your own good, but for the other person's good. Verse 3, for even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. Jesus Christ was the perfect example. You don't see Jesus Christ in the Gospels doing things selfishly. Everything was designed for what's good for the people that I'm talking to. And so he is our perfect example in all of this. And then let's go to Ephesians 4 and verse 29. Ephesians 4, verse 29. And it says, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace or blessings to the hearers. And then also verse 31 and 32. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. Isn't that beautiful? Hard to live up to all the time. This sermon sort of ties in with the sermon I gave back last summer on all about being saved and our role in saving people. As I said in that sermon, I wasn't trying to get us to use the word saved a lot, like going around talking about I'm trying to save people. But yet, that is part of the message of the New Testament, and that is that just as God is trying to save people, you know, we should want to be trying to help save people as well. Let's go to James 5 and verse 19. James 5 and verse 19. Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. You might just have that opportunity at times where you see someone wandering from the truth, from a true way of life, from a godly conduct in some way, and he's straying, he's getting off on a wrong track or wrong path, and you have an opportunity to steer him back onto the right path. If you do, if you're successful, then you have done something God is going to be very, very pleased with. That you sort of rescued somebody from being off on the wrong track where they might have kept going farther and farther off the track. Now let's go to Proverbs 27. I love this chapter of Proverbs because there are several verses that tie together about relationships. And especially about how correction can be out of love and how it can do a lot of good. First of all, verse 5, open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. If you love somebody and he's doing something wrong and you just keep your mouth shut and don't help him to realize he's making a mistake, then that's not true love. If you love somebody, you just don't want to see them walk off a cliff, or about to step in a trap, or about to step on a poisonous snake or something, getting himself into trouble, or listening to the wrong influences. There are times when the true loving thing to do is to give open rebuke. I mean in a tactful way, of course. Verse 6, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. Now, this means wounds that are made to help. In other words, if you come and correct me, my initial emotional reaction might be to feel a little wounded. I mean, I might feel like I'm bleeding a little bit inside at first. But I will soon, if I'm thinking straight, I'm going to right away realize, well, hey, this is good for me. I needed to hear that. Thanks, I needed that. that it, you're coming to me and you're wounding me a little bit because you're a real friend. And you're proving you're a real friend because you're willing to come up and wound me a little bit to get me on the right track. Okay, verse 9. Ointment and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel. Now, I don't know technically what the how we would define hearty. The margin says counsel of the soul. Counsel of the soul. In other words, you're not just talking about superfluous, mundane, unimportant things. It means where you're really talking about nitty-gritty things. You're talking about important things. You're giving each other feedback, and you're talking to each other, and you're counseling each other. You're saying, well, I disagree with that, or, you know, I don't quite agree with that, and here's the way I think it should be and all that. And there's one more verse that ties in, and that is verse 17. Verse 17. Iron, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. Now, do you understand literally how iron sharpens iron? If you have an iron axe, how do you sharpen it? You take an iron file and you start rubbing it. And the way the axe gets sharp is you're scraping off little tiny pieces of steel or iron to make it sharp. Well, you could say, well, if the axe has feelings, well, then that might hurt a little bit. Well, so maybe if we're sharpening each other, it might hurt a little bit, but the result is good. We get sharper, and we need to be sharp. We need to, the old shaving cream ad, you know, look sharp, feel sharp, be sharp. So we need to, at times, sharpen one another. And real friends do sharpen each other. It should make you better because you have good friends that speak the truth. You see, and it's not flattery. And when they disagree, well, they'll tell you they disagree. So the purpose should be to edify, to build up for their good, not to hurt them, to undermine them, to destroy them, to hurt their reputation, to hurt their name, to humiliate them, to put them down, but to help. Number four, what should be the attitude? What should be the attitude? Primarily, humility. Humility. The world is full of know-it-all sideline quarterbacks and Monday morning quarterbacks who act like they know it all and they should have done it this way. And if I, you know, obviously they should have done this or that. And, oh, that was a stupid mistake and all that. And you would think that the way people sound so authoritative about sports that, you know, somehow they would, if they just got out there on the field, they'd be a superstar or something. But they don't realize how difficult it is to be a real coach and or a real quarterback or a real captain and all. So when we come to somebody, it should never be like some know-it-all and like I'm the expert and I'm the authority and you need to look up to me and I'm the superior one and I'm trying to help you poor bumbling orphan to learn to be like me. So let's turn to 2 Timothy 2, 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility correcting those who are in opposition. If God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. You know, if they keep going in the wrong direction, they're more and more in the snare of the devil. But you see, you're hoping to save the person. You're hoping to rescue him and turn him around. But you should do it in humility, Because for one thing, if it's not in humility, he's not nearly as likely to listen anyway. Now let's go to Galatians 6 and verse 1. Galatians 6 and verse 1. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. There's a lot in that verse. The New Living Translation says, "Dear brothers and sisters, if another believer is overcome by some sin, you who are godly should gently and humbly help that person back onto the right path, and be careful not to fall into the same temptation yourself." This is really being part of your brother's keeper. So this is a responsibility we have. Now, if you're not doing it with humility and gentleness, there's more than one problem. First of all, the person is not going to want to listen to you if you're coming on like some superior know-it-all, and you're kind of insulting the way you're doing it. But second, I have noticed, and I warn you, I have noticed in my own life over and over again, if I get self-righteous about something, like, oh, I would never do that, and, you know, I want to point other people's faults out and everything, when I start getting self-righteous about something, I end up falling into the same mistake or sin or wrong attitude or whatever, and I say God kind of pushes me over there. You know, it's like, Don, it's time for you to be humbled. I mean, it can be just little physical things. Like I'll say, oh, if somebody just ate a good diet like me, they would never get that kind of sickness. And then about 2 weeks later, I get that sickness. And it's like, and maybe I've never had that sickness before. But I think, oh, man, I think God did that because I was feeling smug about how I wouldn't get that kind of sickness because I eat a good diet or something like that. So it's all kinds of things like that. Or if I get self-righteous with my wife, like, well, I don't ever do that. I don't ever make that mistake. Then 2 weeks later, I make that mistake. So God very much notices when we are not humble. And then he often does really, really correct us, you see. And then notice verse 3. This all humbles us. Verse 3, for if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. So when we start thinking we're really something, we're actually closer to being nothing. Now let's go back to Matthew 18. Matthew 18 is full of amazing teachings here. And one of the first things it talks about is humility. Jesus picked up a little child, and then in verse 3 he said, "Assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." So when we lose that childlike attitude, we start really getting into trouble. Verse 4, therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And so, boy, that puts it really, really strongly there. So when somebody comes in like a white knight on a horse, I'm the savior and I'm coming in to fix everybody else and straighten everybody else out, that is not done with humility, you see. And then another thing that ties in with humility is to follow the example of God and Jesus Christ about being really, truly concerned about every single person in the world, especially right now, the people that God has called into the church. That we should be deeply concerned for every individual. Verse 10, take heed that you do not despise, and the word despise means to really look down your nose at, one of these little ones. For I say to you that in heaven there are angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and the one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountain to seek the one that is straying? And if he should find it, assuredly I say to you, he rejoices more over that sheep than over the 99 that did not go astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. That shows us the attitude that we must have, deeply concerned about everyone in the church, that we want to help whenever we possibly can. Okay, key number five, to whom should you go when you think of saying something? To whom should you speak? It should be directly to the person who needs the help. And here I am in Matthew 18, and of course, the verse I'm referring to is verse 15. It says, moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. Hey, that's what it's all about. Gaining, not losing, but gaining your brother. Building a relationship, winning him over, and bringing him back closer to God and Jesus Christ. And many people, many ministers and others in our church say this is one of the most neglected verses in the Bible. We've all heard it, but how much do we neglect to do it? It is very difficult to build up the courage and the wisdom to go and talk directly to a person when either the person has hurt you, or you see that he's hurting somebody else, or he's making a serious mistake, or something like this. Now, it says when he sins against you, but the principle is other places in the Bible too, because I've even covered some of the verses already, and that is that when somebody needs for somebody to put a bug in his ear, you know, when he needs to hear something, go to him and don't just complain to somebody else and gossip to others, but go directly and privately to that person and confidentially speak to that person. It seems like the average church member is 10 times more likely to complain to somebody else. Now, I'm not trying to let guilt trip on you for talking to your own wife or your own husband about people in a constructive way, but you know, don't go complaining to others. Now, I know that it's a common thing to have roast minister, and when people go home, oftentimes part of the conversation is what all was wrong with the minister and his wife, and what all was wrong with the messages and all that. But you know, there's a verse, I think it's in Ecclesiastes, that says it's a good thing you don't hear everything that people say, because there's all kinds of bad things. We'd all be depressed if all of us knew everything that other people had said bad about us. So it's a good thing. And sometimes I pray, I say, Father, cause me to hear what I need to hear, and don't let me hear what I'd be better off not hearing. I try to pray that pretty often. Now, again, this applies to ministers too. You know, if you think a minister has hurt you, or a minister is doing something wrong, well, you should go to him. And don't think, well, you can't go talk to a minister because he's a minister. It has nothing to do, nothing whatsoever to do with it. He's just your brother, and you needed to go tell him. Now, usually it means that either the minister has done something wrong, or you've at least perceived it to be wrong. And either way, it's good to talk about it. Now, if the minister should, if he actually did something wrong, he should apologize. And many times when I didn't actually do anything wrong, I still apologize, because I apologize for not making myself more clear. I say, well, here's what I really meant, and so I apologize that I did not make myself more clear. But you don't need to be afraid of ministers. And we're just here as your servants. And we're determined to be approachable and open-minded, very approachable, And another thing is, when somebody comes and corrects you, a lot of times they're a little emotionally upset, and they may come across as negative. But I try not to dismiss what they say just because I don't like the way they deliver the message. In other words, if they come kind of angry and resentful and I think, well, a little bit in a bad attitude, I try to be just as open-minded to what they're saying, because that doesn't mean that their message is wrong. And so I still need to listen, regardless of what kind of attitude they're in. And likewise, if I correct somebody and their initial reaction is to act closed-minded or resentful, I don't form a judgment right away, because I think a lot of people need time to kind of mull things over and think about it. And a lot of times people who have initially have kind of a negative reaction, in the long run, after they think about it and pray about it and all that, then they have a good reaction. They think, well, you know, what he said was right, and I am going to work on that. And they do change. So don't judge people by initial reactions very much. Remember, though, relationships, 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 relationships. They're way more important than things. So often when people are in charge of an activity, you know, they plan out a certain way, and somebody else comes along and they start doing things slightly differently. Like, oh, no, don't do it like that. And they make a big deal out of somebody else doing things a little differently. Hey, what difference does it make exactly how things are done? Let everybody have some freedom to do things their own way, to as much as possible. Don't, especially even if you need to steer them back and say, well, no, this is the way we decided to do it, and so we really do need to do it this way. Say it in a nice way and tactfully, so that you're not hurting their feelings, and you're trying to preserve the relationship, because we are brothers and sisters, and we need to maintain that relationship. We're family, and we cannot afford to alienate our family members. If you get to arguing over some little picky thing, you might win the battle, but you lose the war. You might prove that you're right on that little issue, but you'll end up losing the relationship. And that's a disaster when you do that. Now, the next two verses in Matthew 18 are a little more confusing to know how to apply those. Verse 16 says, but if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. That usually is where somebody else you know is also already involved. Somebody already knows the situation. Maybe they've already been involved, they come along to explain it and verify that what you said is something they experienced also. So sometimes that's applicable. Then verse 17 says, and if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. And in that case, it usually means go to a minister. Not because you're trying to get somebody in trouble, because it's just a matter of wanting help. It's like you're wanting to get some wise counseling and some help to resolve something. It really does need to be resolved, you see. And there are times, I would say there are times when the best way to handle something is to tell a minister. Because, for example, let's say if you found out, somebody's doing something really serious. I mean, maybe, I don't know, stealing, or they're going out and getting drunk, or they're working on the Sabbath or something. But you don't know the person really well yourself, but somehow you know for sure this is happening. And but you know that if you go, it's going to be hard for you to know how to word it, and you don't know the person very well. You haven't really built the bridge with that person and all that, and you know that ministers have a lot of practice in dealing with all kinds of things and will know how best to handle it. So there are times when you know of a fairly serious problem, when the best thing to do is to tell a minister and so that he can deal with it. Number six, and this has to do with how you express yourself and how you approach a person, and this is be respectful, gentle, kind, and tactful as best you can. Be respectful, gentle, kind, and tactful as best you can. This has to do with when you're disagreeing, you don't have to be disagreeable. You don't have to sound so disagreeable just because you disagree. You don't call up and, I mean, you don't approach somebody and say, hey, you stupid, don't you know better? Be tactful. Now let's turn to Colossians 4. Colossians 4, beginning in verse 2. Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. Meanwhile, praying also for us that God would open to us a door of the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in chains, that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak. Paul wrote that he wanted the people to pray for him that he would know how to speak. And likewise, we need to pray for ourselves that God, please guide me as to how to speak, how to express myself. And then verse 5 says, walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. In other words, use your opportunities when you're with people outside the church to make the best impression you can and to establish a good relationship and to be the best kind of influence and light you can be to them. And then verse 6 is good. Let your speech also be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Boy, that really puts my point in very good words. Show me how to season this so it's going to be tasty, so it's going to be palatable, so it'll be acceptable, so the person will receive it, so the person will take a bite and chew on it and show me how to answer people. Do it graciously, with grace. So, if you tend to be blunt and insensitive in the way you talk, well, you need to really pray a lot and work on that. Now, James 1, beginning in verse 19. James really has a lot of practical instructions. James 1, beginning in verse 19. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. So don't be too quick to speak. Think before you speak. Think first. Most of you have heard of the term conflict resolution. We all have conflicts, but conflicts don't do a lot of harm necessarily, but it's important to approach it in the best way, to know how to resolve conflicts in a peaceable, constructive way. So that's the idea. So be very careful with people's feelings, that we're not judgmental and insulting. Make it clear that you just want to be helpful. I think you've heard that it's better to use I statements than you statements, rather than saying, well, you make me mad. You can say, well, when you do a certain thing, I tend to feel a little angry, that it hurts my feelings. Not you hurt my feelings, but when this happens or when somebody says something like this, it hurts my feelings. And so you're just putting it from your point of view. You want to listen well. Don't think you're going to do all the talking. Listen to the other person. Agree as much as possible. Apologize for your own mistakes. And smile and be just as nice and as sweet as you can be about it. When the Spokesman Club manual was being written, and when we were taught how to conduct evaluations in Spokesman Club, we tried to follow the pattern in Revelation 2 and 3. There we have messages to seven churches, and each message starts off with compliments, and then it gets into correction. It says, you have done this and this, which is good, but I have somewhat against you, or I have this that is not acceptable. This needs to be corrected. And so it is very helpful to start off with telling somebody how much you respect them and what you like about them and what you like about what they did or what they said or whatever. And so the positive thing before you get into the negative things. In other words, compliments before correction. And this is very good for parents to do too. And by the way, any good book on parenting says something like, it's good to be give like 10 times more compliments than corrections. Kids will respond much better to correction when they're hearing lots of love and warmth and tenderness and affection and encouragement and pats on the back and approval and support and all of those things. So be respectful when you do come to someone, and gentle and not cold and callous and insensitive. Don't be mean or cruel. Try not to hurt people. Try to be a healer. Try to be a helper. And number seven, the other 6 points were mostly do this and do that. Number seven is don't do this. Number seven is do your best to never gossip, be an accuser, a talebearer, a rumor monger. This is almost always destructive. It doesn't matter sometimes whether the gossip is true or whether it's false. It's nobody's business to hear about other people's mistakes and faults and sins unless they're in a position to do something about it. In other words, if someone comes to a minister to say, well, you know, I notice that so-and-so is doing such and such a serious problem, he's not going to the minister just because he's trying to make points with the minister or because he wants the minister to go jump on this person. He wants the person to get help. When you go to somebody and you share something personal about somebody, it should only be because you know that person is in a position to help. For example, if a kid is doing something wrong, who's the logical person to go to? A parent. The parent is the one who's in the position to do something about it. So don't go complaining about people's kids to other people. But if the kid is doing something and the parent is not aware of that, well, then the logical person to go to is the parent. So you do go to people, other people, when they can help. I mean, if somebody's having a heart attack, you call the EMTs. You call emergency people to come help because they are in the position to help. So to criticize behind people's backs is just always, almost always a bad thing. That old saying, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all, that's largely valid. Gossip often includes speculating about people's motives and attitudes, which you don't know. You know, I would rather have a friend that never said anything good to me, but never said anything bad behind my back, than to have someone who flatters me and says things nice, but then goes and runs me down behind my back. If you're going to be a criticizer, go to the criticizee, the one who really needs to hear it, not other people. Sometimes gossip does terrible wrong, terrible damage. A person's name and reputation can be seriously hurt. It can be something that is totally untrue. It can be something that somebody did a long, long time ago and has long since repented of it. So what good does it do for anybody to know about it at this point? You probably have only part of the knowledge, but not all of it, if there is anything to it. And you don't have the clear picture, the full knowledge anyway, and you're not in a position to do something about it. And you're not even trying to do anything about it because you're not talking to that person. You're talking to somebody else. Proverbs 11, Proverbs 11 and verse 13. A talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of a faithful spirit conceals a matter. In Proverbs 6, beginning in verse 16, Proverbs 6 and verse 16, this is very important. These six things the Eternal hates, yes, seven, are an abomination to him: a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift and running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. We very much need to keep those things in mind. Never be a gossip, an accuser, a talebearer, a rumor monger. All of what I've said today implies that if you are the one getting instruction or correction or constructive criticism, that you should carefully listen. The Bible talks a lot, especially in Proverbs, about the wise versus the foolish. One of the common traits of a wise person is he listens. He's quick to listen. He listens to instruction. He listens to correction. He tries to see if there is some truth in it. He tries to examine himself. He tries to see if, hey, can I use this? Does this apply to me? And learn from it, no matter who's it from. You may not like the messenger, but if you're wise, you don't discard the message just because you don't especially like the messenger. So the Bible has a lot to say about how you receive instruction and correction from others. That's a big subject too, and so maybe I'll have that in another sermon. But I just want to remind you that you can sort of, in a sense, turn a lot of what I said around today, and you can come to a lot of correct conclusions on your own about how to try to receive instruction and correction from others. I hope this has been helpful. You know, we as the saints of God who've been called by God to carry out God's work on earth, we have a very high calling and responsibility. We're a very special group in God's sight, called to be the first fruits, called to be the disciples, called to be the saints, called to be the light of the world, and the people who exemplify right relationships. So much so that the number one sign that Jesus said that would identify converted people is the love that they have one for another. The number one identifying sign of converted people is the love that they have for one another. And that love sometimes includes giving one another constructive criticism. And it should mean that we do our best to avoid any kind of destructive criticism.